This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, more on MSNBC's decision to dump Don Imus and what could come next. Plus, sexual assault charges against three white athletes at Duke University are dropped. And joining us today to talk about these stories and more are Walter Fields, political consultant, Julianne Malveaux, economist and president of Last Word Productions, and Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Welcome, everyone. And Julianne, let me give you the first word coming out of Farah Jasmine Griffin on the dual nature of stereotypes about black women. Oversexed yet masculine. Labor yet a hoe, to use Don Imus's word. So how can a sister win?
In the popular culture that's driven by white men, a sister really can't win, except that we must essentially gird ourselves, if you will, against this kind of stuff by teaching our daughters and teaching others how to be celebrated, how to be educated, how to rise above it. You know, the consistent defeminization of African-American women has it's woven into our very history. As you say, so you're a sexual object, but unattractive at the same time, literally a sexual slave, if you will. Remember, Farai, back in the day, black women couldn't be raped. I mean, white men routinely raped African-American women, but charges were never brought, the notion being you can't rape this woman. Why would you rape this woman? And so we've come a long way since some of those stereotypes had been basically imprinted on people's brains, but we obviously haven't come far enough. I just say the Imus comments, lots of us are angry, and I certainly am, but the word that I think that we really have to look at here is pain. If you looked at those young women, you literally saw their pain. And this is the kind of pain that African-American women, I think, feel when we don't see our images reflected in billboards, when, you know, blonde is pretty. So what are we? Because we're not blonde. It literally the denial of existence, denial of a feminine existence in a culture that worships some forms of femininity.
Walter, looking for love in all the wrong places. That song came to mind because to a certain extent, and I've had this discussion with friends of mine, it's why would you or why should you look to Don Imus to champion your femininity, your racial identity, or anything? It does cut to the core on one level, but on the other level, hasn't there been ample evidence that black folks, including black women, can't always rely on mainstream culture to say, hey, you know, you're great?
Well, none of us can. And I do want to correct one thing from the earlier segment. There was never an apology during the Clinton administration for slavery. He expressed regret. We've never had a U.S. president formally apologize, nor this government. You know, on the issue of the apology and Imus, you know, part of what we have to remember that these individual offenses are made possible by an institutional framework that harbors racism. What I've been concerned about is that we focus so much on Don Imus that we don't focus on MSNBC. I was one of the original contributors on that network. This isn't anything new on this platform. It's an institutional problem, same as redlining, same as citing hazardous waste sites in black neighborhoods or putting black neighborhoods next to railroads and highways. We've got an institutional framework that we've got to address because that's the only way you get to racism. And what's been clear here is that there's been an institutional breakdown. I'm a New Jersey resident. I was born in New Jersey. So I'm concerned also that even on the government side, you heard nothing from the institutional leadership in government in New Jersey. Where was New Jersey's governor? Where was the legislative black caucus? So when you start talking about our young women having no protection, they have no protection because we have no institutions that protect them. So while Imus may have made this egregious offense and he should be off the air, I helped drive Bob Grant off the air, off of New York radio. But he went to another radio station. Until we start talking about the institutional framework that gives these people voice, our children will always be subject to these type of attacks.
Ron, money, obviously, a huge issue here. There must be profit in being an on-air racist. Certainly, Don Imus is not the first person to say things like these, and he's not done it for the first time. How do you take the profit out of being someone who is a racist on the air or a sexist on the air or any other distinction like that?
One of the things that troubles me the most, Farai, about this is exactly what you've touched upon, which is the profitability. These are corporations who understand the behavior of some of the people they hire, some of the people that they put on the airwaves, and they turn a blind eye to it because they're looking at the bottom line. And it's not just MSNBC and Don Imus. It's the record companies. You know, if you look at the Billboard top 10 songs this week, the conservative columnist Michelle Malkin had a column. The first several songs on there have lyrics that go even far worse than what Don Imus had to say, and you're putting this pollution in the heads of our children, and yet these record companies reap these dramatic profits, and you don't hear them say one word about the conduct of these artists that they put on their airwaves. So I think it speaks to a broader context, not just Don Imus and a news program, but the record executives and some of the programming that purports to be entertainment out there that has terrible stereotypes, terrible language, and sends a terrible message to our kids.
You know, Farai, if I could just say one more thing about this. I just wanted to make sure that we all remember the legacy of the late C. Dolores Tucker, because I think that, you know, she spent her time, and in fact, her life might have been at least a little bit shortened if she died last year, by her battles with the hip-hop folk who have those degrading lyrics. They responded by putting her into one of the degrading lyrics, actually. But that was her crusade, was to make us be more accountable about what black folks are saying about black folks, what black artists are saying about African-American women. Imus really is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, what he said was so deplorable, I don't think anyone in America could defend him. But the fact is that these images, all you have to do is turn on certain television stations to see black women in imagery and hear the kind of language that Imus used, being used by their brothers.
Well, Walter, this may be a little bit of a digression, but I was at the hair parlor the other day getting my locks twisted, and I was flipping through Jet, and there was a whole section on video vixen entrepreneurs and how they are a new class, I guess a new aspirational class. And it strikes me that there is, although this is in the context of a white man making comments about black women, there is a huge array of intra-African-American discussion that has to go on around the use of the word like ho, which was not minted by Don Imus.
It was not. And I think what you're seeing, it's funny, that it is about profit and it is about money making. And I've always said, you know, if you look at this generation, if you're 27 or younger, you were born right after 1980, after the Reagan administration. I think a lot of our kids absorbed that materialism from the Reagan era in a wicked sort of way, and it's playing out on us today. So when you start talking about, you know, video vixens, when you start talking about music videos, you know, we contribute to that because we see it as a way to make money, divorcing itself from the social dynamic. And I think, you know, C. Dolores Tucker was absolutely right, but she also not only took on the artists, she took on the corporate honchos. Because what really disturbs me is that it's a bunch of middle-aged white men who are facilitating this discussion, who sit in the record company suites, who sit in the MSNBC suites. You know, these are the people who are making decisions that put our young women in this type of position. And the easy marks are the Imuses, the easy marks are the hip-hop artists. Let's go to the corporate suite where those decisions are made, and I can guarantee you no one that looks like me is in that room making that decision.
Ron, before we go, Reaganomics helped shape hip-hop materialism?
No, I don't think so. I think that there was a culture, particularly in the 80s and the 90s, of the materialism, I want everything and I want it now, but I'm certainly not going to attribute it to Ronald Reagan. As much as I agree with Walter's underlying premise, I'm certainly not going to put it at the footsteps of Ronald Reagan.
We could blame him for some other stuff, though, so
it's okay. And we could blame President Clinton for
everything. I'll blame him for that, too, because the materialism and greed of the Reagan era are part and parcel of what we're feeling today.
All right, well, we have a lot more to talk about. I got to move on.
Oh, come on, Ryan.
All right, guys.
You can't hear Republicans.
We got to move topics.
Without spouting off about President Clinton. Just stop it.
For the Democrats.
All right. Got to move along. In case you're just tuning in, it's NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We have got Julianne Malveau, economist and president of Last Word Productions, Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush, and Walter Fields, political consultant. Let's move on to another sports controversy. Yesterday, prosecutors in North Carolina dropped the sexual assault charges that had been brought against three Duke University students just over a year ago. And the three white students were charged by the Durham County District Attorney last April after an African-American stripper accused them of assaulting her during an off-campus party. Now, are they owed an apology? If so, by whom? Ron.
This case is disgusting to me on so many levels. First of all, yesterday, looking at the coverage, these three young athletes were treated like heroes. They came in the room and everyone was clapping. The fact remains that they hired two women to come and perform in a sexually explicit manner. I think that that is disgusting. No one talks about the underlying fact of what they had done to put themselves in the situation. But to get to your specific question of who is owed an apology, I think that the district attorney from Durham County, Mr. Nifong, not only owes these kids an apology, but I think he's going to get hit with a civil lawsuit. For goodness sakes, as a lawyer, I can tell you that when you walk into that courtroom or if you present evidence as an officer of the court representing the people, if you are bringing a case that is lacking evidence, if you're bringing a case that's faulty on the merits, and you're putting people in a terrible position, particularly on matters of race and privilege, as to what he did with these three young lacrosse players, I think it's despicable. And the last thing I'd say is, where's the outrage? You know, you've seen Al Sharpton come down, and you've seen the 80 professors from Duke University who condemned these kids and called them hooligans, same as what Mr. Nifong had said. I think these people who were so quick to rush to judgment, I want them to come back and to make an apology, because I think that what they've done to inflame racial tensions in this country is disgusting.
You know what? Those kids don't deserve an apology. As you said correctly, they hired strippers, exotic dancers, to come and perform for them. They were students. It was the lacrosse team. They were known for hooliganistic behavior. Separate and apart from what happened to this woman.
Absolutely.
So no, they don't deserve any apologies at all.
From the prosecutor, though. From the prosecutor.
Perhaps from Mr. Nifong, but that's about it.
I agree.
Not from the professors, not from anyone else. Furthermore, obviously the woman, the victim in this case, has changed her story a couple of times. Obviously, there's a lot going on. They said that they reviewed her mental health history and that they won't be bringing charges against her because she may truly believe some of these versions. Well, frankly, I believe that something did happen. We don't know what, but we do know that something happened. We know that these guys lied about their names, so she had difficulty identifying. But if something happened to this woman, and she deserves a lot of our compassion.
Reverend Jackson, let me finish, please.
Reverend Jackson, has offered to pay her way through school, and I think that's a fine offer, and I hope that she takes him up on it. But I really, I think something happened here. I think these guys are bad apples. They may not be able to prove rape. You may not be able to prove anything. But something did happen there.
Walter, Julianne has used the term victim. If we don't know what happened, and we know that at least so far the legal process shows that these three young men who were the athletes were not guilty of any legal malfeasance, should she still be called a victim, regardless of what her mental state is?
Well, I think Duke and the Raleigh community are the real victims here, and they're victimized by our inability to confront issues of race. You know, what's really clear here is that we do have boys behaving badly. They may not have committed a rape, but clearly there is behavior going on that is not productive in a college environment or in society in general. I mean, we live in an era where we have, the Girls Gone Wild series. I mean, what is that about? So part of it is this notion that, boys behaving badly become men behaving badly. And I think part of what we've got to talk about is, no, I don't think, an apology is owed by the professors at Duke to these young men. I do think this district attorney should apologize to the Duke community and to the Raleigh community and to the boys for not prosecuting this case in the proper manner. But beyond that, I think we've got to get to this notion of, what type of environment are we creating? And, it's funny. We have this case and we have the Imus case. And, I'm angry this morning, mainly because when I think about this sort of stuff, I was seething last night because I'm watching the news. And on one hand, they're talking about Anna Nicole's baby and celebrating who the father is. And on the other hand, we're talking about someone who called these young black women hoes. It's like, give me a break. When are we going to have a truthful conversation about race in this country that really gets to the core of it? The reason why there was this rush to judgment in the Duke case is because it was so easy to believe that young white men behaving badly raped this black woman. And I think we've got.
Walter, the conversation has to be a conversation about race and gender.
Without a doubt, Julianne. Without it, I agree with you wholeheartedly. But underneath all of this is this notion, particularly when it comes to young white men, the exploitation of young black girls, and no one is talking about the institutional dynamic in this, that this happens at college campuses. These parties happen all the time where they bring in strippers. Why should our young black women be put in a position where they have to go strip at a party to make their way through college?
While they're students.
And it's not just black women. I need to go. I know I'm cutting you guys off, and it's just getting hot. But we have 2 minutes, and I just want to mention one last topic, completely different. The defense secretary just announced yesterday that he would extend the tours of all active-duty troops now serving in or heading to Iraq or Afghanistan to 15 months from a year. 15 months on, 12 months off. Bonus round, final question, very quickly. Walter, Julianne, then Ron, will this hurt the president's move to have a surge of new troops coming in?
I think the president's move has already been hurt. You know, so I think the notion is there's tremendous pressure now on Capitol Hill to put a deadline in place. I think that is actually going to happen. So I don't think this necessarily hurts it any more than it can be. He's already injured on this issue.
Julianne. You know, it's... Basically, it hurts the policy, but even more, it hurts the Army. The Army is already overstretched. I mean, you're going to stretch them even further. It's going to make it difficult to keep people in. It's going to make it more unattractive for people to join. He's put the defense secretary is pushing us towards a draft, and that's the thunk for the American people. People do not want a draft. Basically, it's saying this war in Iraq will be over sooner rather than later because it undermined our ability to execute it, which is a good thing.
Ron. I don't think it has anything to do with the draft. I don't think we'll ever have the reinstitution of a draft in this country. But let's take this thing, let's put it in perspective. These young soldiers are on 12-month deployments. They are being extended by an additional 3 months. I think it, unfortunately, is the reality of what's going on the ground in Iraq. They face a very difficult situation. There are more terrorists and insurgents who are coming in, and we need additional troops to try to get the stability. But no, I don't think this is going to hurt the president in the long run. This, unfortunately, has dragged down his popularity, and I think that that's going to be the remainder of his administration. But history, I think, will judge the president and his actions for what he's tried to do to fight and wage and win the war on terrorism much differently than the public perception right now.
Nothing to do with Iraq.
Well, this was you hope that it won't hurt the president,
it's a wrap.
You know
it's a wrap. We have no time, and we could go on. Muy caliente. Thank you. From our studios in Washington, D.C., Julianne Malveaux, economist and president of Last Word Productions, plus Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm D.C. Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. In New York, Walter Fields, political consultant. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.